OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Korach, and recording and first broadcast is Thursday, Yom Chamishi, 23rd day of Sivan 5768, 26th day of June 2008. This Shabbat we announce and bench the Rosh Chodesh of Tammuz, which will be next Thursday and Friday. Sivan has 30 days in our fixed calendar. Whenever that happens, its 30th day is the first day of Rosh Chodesh of the new month, and then the first day of Tammuz follows on Friday as the second day of Rosh Chodesh. I imagine if people are not familiar with that, it's kind of confusing sounding, but it's a simple matter of two possible candidates for the sanctity of Rosh Chodesh are the day following the 29th of a month, because it could be the first of the new month, and the first of the new month. So sometimes, like when you have a 29-day month, the day following the 29th is the first day of the new month, one day Rosh Chodesh. When you have 30 days in a month, then the day following the 29th is the 30th. The following day is also a candidate for the sanctity of Rosh Chodesh, being the first of the new month, and we have 2 days Rosh Chodesh. That, believe it or not, was a clarification of the previous confusing statement, but perhaps it was even more confusing. Let's suffice it to say that this Shabbat around the world in Jewish communities and shuls, the announcement and the blessing of the new month will take place. And that month will be Tammuz, which begins next Thursday, Friday. As for now, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tehiena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi velidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mi kol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara liyirvacha u'me'afela la'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. When we play music on the show, I like it to be from a variety of different albums. I gravitate towards Shabbat-oriented music because this is an Erev Shabbat show. Torah Tibbetz Audio started years ago on a Wednesday night. It was then moved to Thursday night and was meant to be a Shabbat welcoming day. On Israel National Radio, the first broadcast of this show is 5 o'clock in the afternoon Israel time of Thursday, but it's repeated at 8 and at 11 and at 2 in the morning of Friday and 5 in the morning and several other times, I think, during Friday. So it is definitely an Erev Shabbat, a preparation for Shabbat show. And regardless of when you're listening to it, you get a dose of the Shabbat music. The song I have for you now is maybe the best association people have. You say somebody, Kabbalat Shabbat, they're likely to answer, Lecha Dodi. And that is exactly the name of this song. A number of years ago, I coined a term. I don't remember having heard it in the past. So even if it's not original, it is original to me. The term is contextual mitzvot. If you take a look at the 613 mitzvot in the Torah, you will find some of them are exceedingly tied to the storyline of that portion of the Torah where we find them. And you find other mitzvot that just are presented as if they are being listed without any connection to the text. It is the former type that I just described, which I call contextual mitzvot. For example, back in the book of Bereshit, when God commands us to circumcise males at 8 days old, it is definitely a contextual mitzvah put there together with the story of the dedication and commitment of Avraham Avinu on purpose. And in fact, Brit Milah is not just the physical removal of the foreskin. It is a commitment to enter the child into the covenant of Abraham. So it is most definitely a contextual mitzvah. On the other hand, just as an example, the mitzvah of Sha'atnez, the prohibition of wearing garments that contain wool and linen mixed together, is not in any particular context. And even if there is something to be learned by its juxtaposition to another mitzvah, that doesn't make it a contextual mitzvah. My use of the term refers to coming out of a story. The laws of the Passover sacrifice and matzah and chametz definitely are contextual because they are embedded within the story of the Exodus in the book of Shemot. And many mitzvot, I don't know how it breaks down numerically, but there are many mitzvot that are contextual, and there are many, many mitzvot that are not. I would suspect fewer mitzvot are contextual. And that brings me to introduce Parshat Korach. Korach was a cousin, first cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu and Aharon HaKohen. And Korach had a beef, a bone to pick with Moshe, with Aaron, with God. It's very hard to figure out exactly who his primary target was. And according to a composite of some of the commentaries, this is the way that I explain it. Korach was the son of Yitzhar. Yitzhar was the brother of Amram, Moshe's brother, Moshe's father. Amram was the eldest child, and second of four boys was Yitzhar. All right, Moshe Rabbeinu ends up being the leader of the people, the king, if you will. His brother, Aharon HaKohen, becomes the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. The family leader of the Kahat branch of Levi was given to a younger cousin of a brother younger than his father, and Korach was very, very jealous, envious, upset, call it what you want. But he chose to attack, to rebel against Moshe in public, and create a dissension among the people, which had disastrous results, because it was Korach's elite group of incense bringers who were struck dead by a divine fire. It was his co-rebellion partners, Datan and Aviram, and many others who were swallowed up by the earth. Which of those two fates, or both, was Korach's is disputed in commentaries. But the bottom line is, the whole first portion of this week's Torah reading of Korach, the name of the Sedra, Korach, is a focus on the story of this rebellion of a Levite, of a cousin of Moshe, joined by members of the tribe of Reuven, and Reuven were perfect fodder for Korach's rebellion. I could picture in my mind Korach talking to the people of Reuven and saying, I was passed over for the honors in my tribe. Look at your tribal ancestor Reuven, firstborn of Yaakov, repeatedly referred to as the Bechor, passed over for the kingship which goes to Yehuda, passed over for the double portion of the Bechor which goes to Yosef, passed over for the spiritual functionaries of the nation which went to Levi in the form of Kohanim and Leviim. And I could see easily how the people of Reuven would rally to Korach in fighting against the establishment. But that's not yet my point, because if we take a look after the bulk of the Sedra is the story of Korach and his rebellion and the aftermath, which was just as tragic, if not more, we then find a set of 9 mitzvot in Parshat Korach where it is patently obvious that they exist there in context of the story of Korach to be what I called contextual mitzvot. Now the point is that all mitzvot were taught by God to Moshe on Sinai. They all come from Sinai. It's how God chose to disperse them throughout the Torah that teaches us things. It is clear, in my opinion, that having these specific mitzvot placed in Parshat Korach ought to make the connection. Korach, and I even put it like this, the story of Korach we can be a little bit detached from. Once upon a time, a long time ago, this is what happened, and we learn lessons from it, but it does not impact on us as powerfully as having a body of mitzvot which clearly set up the fact that the Jewish people do have subdivisions, that there are Kohanim, that there are Leviim, and there are Yisraelim, Israelites. And the Kohanim have specific duties and tasks and privileges which are not interchangeable for any other Jew. A non-Kohen cannot get up on the platform and say Birchat Kohanim to a congregation. That is the job of a Kohen. It's true that fathers borrow, so to speak, the Kohen's blessing to bless their own children and grandchildren in private on Friday night. All right, that might be a little bit of taking something, but certainly not the function of the Kohen. The Kohen has his privileges, he has things which we give him as gifts, some of which only apply during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, others apply in our own time as well. Take, for example, Pidyon HaBen, which happens to be one of the mitzvot in Parshat Korach. A non-Kohen, non-Levi man, his wife not being a daughter of a Kohen or of a Levi, they have her first child, and it's a boy. A Bechor, for the purpose of Pidyon HaBen, does not have to be the man's first child. A man can have 10 firstborns for Pidyon HaBen from 10 different women. Definition of Pidyon HaBen is the offspring which opened the woman's womb. And if it's a boy, he has a certain status and requires redemption at 30 days of age, after 30 days, and 5 silver shkalim, or the monetary equivalent of that in silver, are given to a Kohen in exchange for the child, so to speak. As long as it's in this week's Sedra, we'll talk about it a little bit more. And that is that redemption of a firstborn is a requirement. It is not optional. Interestingly, the ceremony of a Pidyon HaBen includes the Kohen saying to the father, which do you prefer, these five silver shkalim or your firstborn son? And you do run into sometimes a wise guy father who will get a laugh out of the assembled by hesitating, by posturing as if he's thinking it out, by weighing it. It's not an option. Why it's part of the ceremony, I'm not even sure. But it's not an option. It is an absolute requirement on the father to redeem his firstborn son. If a father does not do that, then it devolves on the child himself when he comes of age, the age of mitzvot, to redeem himself. In the meantime, he might be redeemed via his mother's insistence or the community or whatever, but essentially a person redeems himself if he had not been redeemed as a child. As I mentioned before, if a man or his wife have a father who's a Kohen or a Levi, meaning if the child in question has either grandfather, a Kohen or a Levi, the child does not require redemption and there is no Pidyon HaBen. But if both grandfathers are Yisrael, non-Kohen, non-Levi, then there is Pidyon HaBen for that child. Aside from Pidyon HaBen, many other gifts of the Kohen are mentioned in this Sedra on purpose, because Korach's point was, who appointed you? And the answer was, God appointed him. And God is the one who gave the rules of Kohen, the rules of Levi, the rules of Yisrael, and the interdependence of all of them, which I'll talk about a little bit more after a quick break for whatever announcements Arut Sheva puts in this slot and the OU does not. Whether you follow that or not, we'll be right back.
I'm Rod Sterling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
Welcome back. Been away long? I guess not. We were talking about Pidyon HaBen as one of the gifts of the Kahuna. There are many, many others, a total of 24. Some apply in our time, some don't. And they find their context here in Parshat Korach because that was part of Korach's challenge to Moshe and to God and the authority that he was giving the Kohen and Levium and Yisraelim. And Korach, you know, begged to differ. It's, I guess, not as simple as that, but that's part of the story. And God has to set down very clearly in this context that there are rules. A Levi is required to do guard duty in the Beit HaMikdash, or around the Beit HaMikdash, I should say. A Kohen has 3 watch posts every night within the Beit HaMikdash. The Levi covers 21 different watch posts. A Kohen can't interchange jobs with a Levi and vice versa. A Yisrael can't do the job of either a Kohen or a Levi. And there is a body of rules and regulations governing the Kohen and our behavior towards the Kohen, the Levi and our body of behavior towards the Kohen, and some guidelines of a Levi's relationship to a Kohen. But this is all what Korach tried to dissolve and to blur, and this is exactly what God, via the Torah in this context, has to set down as the rules. And it's very, very serious. Even within Levi, let's say, you had some Levium that were assigned guard duty. You had other Levium that were part of the choir. A non-choir member of Levi who sings with the choir is in violation of a very serious sin in the Torah, punishable by death from heaven. I don't know how Levy goes about getting a change of assignment, but that's not the point. It sounds very, very serious and harsh, and it is. And it's there because we don't flippantly treat the duties of the Kohen or the Levy or the responsibility of the Israel towards them. On another note related to this, of course, is something that I always like to remind people of, especially myself not being a Kohen or a Levi. Kohanim in place in the Beit HaMikdash, Leviim in place in the Beit HaMikdash. Everything at the morning is ready to go. They're only waiting for sunrise. There it is, sunrise. No function in the Beit HaMikdash can take place. Not the bringing of the morning sacrifice, not the tending of the menorah, not the offering of the incense. Nothing takes place until a Yisrael on duty gives the go-ahead signal for the Kohanim to commence their avoda and the Levim to commence their song and whatever else they do. There is a partnership. Obviously, that's not an equal partnership. But there are a lot of offsetting things. Kohanim and Levim don't receive land in Eretz Yisrael like all the other tribes do. The tribes have dues that they have to give to Kohanim. There's a relationship, an interdependence, but a very important point here, which was what Korach had to learn, and Moshe tried to tell him, Rav Lachem B'nei Levi, you don't have enough on your plate by being Levim, you're asking for more, it can't be done. Now I would like to suggest, before I suggest that, let me just say this. A Kohen can't be a non-Kohen, and a non-Kohen can't be a Kohen. So forget about wanting to be the other and concentrate on doing your share in the best possible way. I feel, and this was the comment I was about to make before, I feel that this applies to men and women as well. There is no point in a man saying, I want to give birth. He can't. That's not how he was made by God. And therefore, aside from a little twinge of jealousy when he sees his wife bonding with their son in a way that he can't, you can't have more than a jealousy. Otherwise, it consumes you for no purpose. Rather, be the best father that you could be. And the same thing goes in a religious context. There are mitzvot that men are obligated to perform and women are exempt. The list of mitzvot that women are exempt is relatively short, and most of that list, a woman can do the mitzvah if she wants. There are two, among which is one very notable exception, which is the mitzvah of tefillin, where a woman who is not obligated to wear tefillin should not wear tefillin. Some go as far as saying it's forbidden to wear tefillin, although there are opinions that say it's not forbidden, it's just not done. Talit, to a lesser extent, for technical reasons of the sanctity of the tefillin themselves, their intrinsic kedusha, but it exists with talit also. A woman who puts on a talit is, in my opinion, exercising an unhealthy envy of something that she's not obligated to do and by tradition doesn't do and hasn't done, and there is no good reason for her to want to do that. If she's doing it because I'll be damned if I'll let a man have a mitzvah that I don't have, that's off base. That is not a healthy kind of thing. That's even a Korach kind of rebellion. If she has other noble spiritual aspirations, I believe she has to be taught that a woman manifests and develops those spiritual aspirations differently from the way that a man does. And I know what I'm saying now is opening myself to comment, and I welcome it. If anyone has anything to say, please email me, and we'll, so to speak, discuss it in future weeks. My email for Torah Tidbits Audio is tta@ouisrael.org. There are, by the way, or maybe not by the way, there are many things that women traditionally don't do, which they can do, and maybe they should do. And there is plenty of room for a woman who wants to do more than her mother did, to grow spiritually without having to step across that traditional barrier. I can't say that everyone holds it is forbidden for a woman to wear a tallit. But women are exempt and have kept their exemption throughout the generations, and I am hard put to find a good justification for a woman to go against that. Especially because there is an opinion that they are forbidden to wear tallit. But even if you dismiss that opinion, which is not easy to do because it's the opinion of a Tana, one of the authors of the Mishnah, it goes way back. But even if you say, we don't follow that opinion, it does not mean that a woman should go and wear a tallit. I believe it is generally, I imagine there could be an exception to this, generally an unhealthy direction for a girl to take. There are other things that a girl can grow in, a woman can grow in, which are also not the typical role of women, but there's no reason why it shouldn't be, and that's the direction to go. Korach was not only wrong for saying, who made you, God, and who made you, the Kohen Gadol? I want to do that also. I've always been puzzled by the fact that he had 250 well-meaning people who took a fire pan and a glowing coal and put incense on it to make an offering, which they all knew was permitted only by Aharon the Kohen. And they died because of it. I don't understand what they had in mind. You know, you could argue out loud and scream and yell and rant and rave, but when it comes down to doing something that you should know is playing with fire, in this case literally, and the pun is intended, that it's not a smart thing to do. So I really can't explain well why they did what they did, but they did not succeed. I want to now go in a different direction, but as an interlude between these two different ideas, I would like to play a famous clip by a brilliant comedian who passed away earlier this week or the end of last week, George Carlin. I used to like him very much. I found that in later years he got more vulgar and, in my opinion, less funny because of it. But I go back to the days when his humor was clean and very, very funny. This piece, which you will listen to in a moment, is his famous baseball versus football analysis, and I play it in honor of his memory, George Carlin, dead at the age of 71.
I'd like to do something called baseball and football because these two things are such a part of our lives, these two activities, and yet they're so different. Baseball is pastoral, 19th century. Football is technological, 20th century. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park. The baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium. War Memorial Stadium. In baseball, you wear a cap. In football, you wear a helmet. Baseball has a seventh inning stretch. Football has a 2-minute warning. Baseball has no time limit. We don't know how long it's going to last. We might have extra innings. Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death. Football is based on downs. What down is it? Baseball is based on ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. In football, you get a penalty. In baseball, you make an error. Whoops. In baseball, in the stands, there's something of a picnic feeling. You know, emotions may run high, but there's not that much unpleasantness. In football, in the stands, you can be sure that at least 27 times during the game you were capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. And to sum this up, the objects of the game is quite different. The object of the game in football is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home. I'm going home. I'm going home.
I don't know how many shows that you will find which will have Divrei Torah and a comedy clip by George Carlin. So I get a certain kick out of that, and I hope you appreciate it as well. Speaking of baseball, it was announced after a long wait a couple of weeks ago that Israel Baseball League, which played its inaugural season last summer, 2007, would not be playing this summer, 2008, and was trying to regroup for 2009. That announcement saddened me greatly because I have very fond memories of the baseball season last summer. I had season's tickets to the Modian Miracle Games. I went to 13 different games. And when my eldest daughter said, "What are you trying to make up for 25 years of living here?" I said, "Yeah, exactly so." And I had the privilege of and the pride and the joy of taking my eight-year-old grandson to his first games, introducing him into baseball, signing him up to a baseball chug, and now he plays second base for his little league team. And a year ago, he knew nothing about the game at all. So that's a particular pride of an expatriate American, we'll say. When I came in Aliyah, the things that I missed included tuna fish and aluminum foil and peanut butter. And over the years, we got good tuna fish and we got good quality aluminum foil available, and we have peanut butter. And now with the diet that I'm on, I only use the 100% natural peanut butter, and that is very good here. And it boils down to the only thing that I was missing was baseball, and then the internet came along with the ability to listen to games on the internet, or watch them if you want even, and that was no longer something that I missed. And the one remaining thing, which I had to skip a generation for, was taking my child and signing him up for Little League and watching them play and even coaching a little. So that I'm able to do. Anyway, last week there was an announcement saying our announcement of no season this summer was premature. There will be a season. It will be abridged to a 20 game for each team, 4 teams instead of 6, like last summer, and hopefully much more the coming summer. But at least from July 27th and into the towards the end of August, we're expecting to have a baseball season of some sorts. The returning champions are the Beit Shemesh Blue Sox. They will be joined in this revised league by the Netanya Tigers, Modian Miracle, and the new team, Jerusalem Gold. I hope to keep you posted on the developments of the Israel Baseball League here in Israel. I know that from last summer's teams, several of the players went on to much bigger and better things, and it's very nice to see it. Is a sign of the decent quality that Israel Baseball League had last summer, that you have a pitcher from the Israel Baseball League who is now playing in a high-quality team in Japan, and another fellow who's playing for a Triple-A team for the Yankee system, and a couple other guys, somebody in Mexico. So we had good quality stuff. It was not major league level, but it was extremely enjoyable. Enough said on that, maybe more than enough. I want to take a look at something which the Sedra mentions, which other Sedras also mention, and it's a comment that I've made before, but I think it's a very interesting and poignant conclusion that can be drawn from it. There are three types of Bechor, firstborn. I mentioned earlier the firstborn of a human, male, offspring, opener of the womb, requires redemption, period. It applies today as it always has applied, and there is no other thing that's allowed to be done but Pidyon HaBen, redemption. Then you have, I'll skip over the kosher animals, come back to them, you have Peter Chamor, the firstborn of a donkey. Female donkey, called in Hebrew Aton, called in English, if I'm not mistaken, a Jenny. Firstborn of that donkey, if it's a male, does not have sanctity, but is forbidden for its owner to derive any benefit from it until it is redeemed. Redemption here is by taking the baby donkey to a Kohen, giving the Kohen a sheep, or the money equivalent of a sheep, in redemption of the firstborn donkey. A bracha is recited, a ceremony is undergone. Here in Israel, when it's done, there's a band that's invited to play music, and there's a buffet that's put out. It's a glorious celebration of Pidyon Peter Chamor, which is not that common to see. People go through their entire religious Jewish lives without ever having witnessed a Pidyon Peter Chamor. But it exists, and it applies today, and it's still done today. Then you have, oh, I should also say, that if a person who owns a donkey refuses to redeem the firstborn, which is by far the preferred procedure according to the Torah, then the animal must be destroyed and the carcass buried. This is also a mitzvah, but unlike other mitzvot, this one has the clear picture of God frowning upon a person who avails himself of this command, because he should redeem it. But if he doesn't, then there's that secondary mitzvah called Arifa, Arifat Peter Chamor. Then you have kosher domesticated farm animals, cow, goat, and sheep. Other kosher animals that are considered not behema, but chaya, non-domesticated animals, like wild goat, antelope, deer, giraffe, water buffalo, and a whole bunch of others, do not have the mitzvah of Bechor that I'm going to describe. It doesn't exist, and it does not exist for any other non-kosher animal other than a donkey. There is no nothing that's to be done with a firstborn horse or camel or deer or water buffalo, etc., etc. Cow, goat, and sheep. A female cow, a female goat, a female sheep. Female goat is called a nanny. Female sheep is called a ewe, E-W-E, in Hebrew, a rachel. And cow. I just took a look at my recording time, and I'm in trouble. I'm not going to have time to finish this topic. Let's quickly summarize. A cow, goat, and sheep, firstborn male offspring, is sacred, must be given after a certain waiting period to a Kohen of your choice to be brought as a special sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash. The mitzvah applies today, but we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, and therefore our sages have said, get out of this mitzvah, do not do it, because you cannot redeem the animal. That's one of the mitzvot in Parshat Korach. You must get out of this mitzvah to avoid the pitfall of giving the Kohen a sacred animal, which he has nothing to do with, but to take care of at his own expense without deriving any benefit. I apologize for cutting this short. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah. Okay, that Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah was for the listeners on Israel National Radio. If you're listening on OU Radio, I would like to apologize for apologizing for cutting it short and not cut it short, and spend a little bit more time on that point. It goes back, I mean, there's pieces that I missed. Let's do it again. We're talking about Bechor Behema Tahora, the firstborn of a kosher domesticated farm animal. Behema, domesticated or farm animal. Tahora is the Hebrew term for kosher. Interesting that kosher, of course, comes from the Hebrew, but the correct term for kosher animals versus non-kosher animals are behema tahora versus behema temeya, or chaya tahora and chaya temeya. Okay, so here's the situation. You have a female sheep pregnant for her first time. At the end of a gestation period of 145 days, an offspring is born, and it is male. At the moment of birth, the offspring becomes kodesh, sacred. The firstborn donkey that I spoke about earlier was not sacred. Firstborn human being, in that sense, is not either. Firstborn cow, goat, or sheep, in the case of this example, a sheep, a lamb, is kodesh at birth. The owner is supposed to say it is kodesh, but even if he doesn't say that, the animal is still kodesh when it is yotzei la'avir ha'olam, when it comes into the air of the world. Literal translation. Then the owner, you in this case, has to take care of the sheep for 30 days, feed it, tend it, not benefit from it at all, and at the end of that period, give it as a gift to the Kohen of your choice. The Kohen is duty-bound to accept it, because otherwise it would be an insult to the gifts of the Kohuna, and for the status of the Kohen. And he is required to bring it to the Beit HaMikdash within its first year of life and offer it as a sacrifice called Bechor, most of which comes back to him after it's offered on the altar, and he then prepares it and eats it with his family and enjoys a good meal. If the animal is unfit for the Mizbeach, then it belongs to the Kohen to do as he pleases. It gets a little bit complicated, but let's leave that part out for now. Fact. This mitzvah applies in our time. That came to me as a surprise the first time I learned that. It turns out that the mitzvah of the sanctity of the Bechor of a domesticated farm animal, kosher, exists today, with the complication of not having a Beit HaMikdash at the moment in order to offer it as a sacrifice. But it still has to go that way. Meaning, you take care of it for 30 days, you give it to the Kohen of your choice, he probably grudgingly says thank you, accepts it, has to take care of it for its entire life, if it's that long, and because it is supposed to go on to the Mizbeach, the fact that we don't have an altar at this time to offer it as a sacrifice does not change its inherent kedusha, its inherent sanctity, and he would never be allowed to derive any benefit from it, although having to go through the expense of taking care of it, shearing it when it requires the shearing, burying the wool since he can't derive any benefit from it, etc., etc. Come the sages and say, no way that you should do this mitzvah if you can get out of it, because it would put an unbearable stumbling block before the Kohen. Kohen is not allowed to blemish it, is not allowed to drive it up into the country and abandon it, not allowed to sell it, not allowed to slaughter it, can't derive any benefit from it, and it could be a very frustrating experience. So the sages say, you have to get out of this mitzvah, and we're going to teach you how to do it. It's fairly simple. Go to a non-Jew of your acquaintance before the sheep gives birth, and sell to that person a small share, a tenth of a percent, of the animal, in making, give me a shekel, give me a quarter, give me a nickel for whatever percentage we're talking about. And you now have the case of a pregnant sheep that is jointly owned by Jew and non-Jew. And even though the balance of the equity in the partnership is very, very skewed, it's still considered a partnership. And when that lamb is born, there is no sanctity to it. There is no mitzvah of Bechor, no giving it to a Kohen, no bringing it as a korban. It is yours to keep free and clear. So Shulchan Aruch, the code of law, says this is how you get out of this mitzvah, and the rabbis command you to get out of this mitzvah, because it creates an untenable situation if you don't get out of it. Okay. The next chapter that deals with Peter Chamor, which I mentioned much earlier, the firstborn of a donkey, the Shulchan Aruch says like this. Remember what I told you last chapter of how to get out of that mitzvah? Well, I have to tell you, it'll work if you do it with this donkey. But don't. Don't get out of it, because there is no complication and no difficult situation in letting this mitzvah take its course, and you should do a mitzvah. True, it's going to cost you a sheep, or it'll cost you the value of a sheep. And you might think, I can save myself X number of dollars, however much a sheep is worth, by getting out of this mitzvah, by making a partner with the pregnant female donkey, with a non-Jew. Shulchan Aruch says, if you do that, it'll work. You won't lose the sheep. It won't cost you any money to do Pidyon Peter Chamor, but you will have gotten yourself out of a situation of mitzvah, and that's not nice. That's not proper. Now, I find these two things side by side extremely poignant. On the one hand, telling you, do a mitzvah. See, there are plenty of mitzvot that are obligatory. So you don't need Shulchan Aruch to say more than, you must eat a certain portion of matzah on Seder night. Period. You can't get out of it, unless you're very sick. But we're not talking about that. You can't get out of it. It's an obligation. Here is a mitzvah that you have an opportunity to remove the mitzvah from becoming an obligation, and some people might go in that direction, but Shulchan Aruch says, please don't do that, because you've got a mitzvah to perform. More poignant is the other side, back with a cow, goat, and sheep, where Shulchan Aruch, which, so to speak, dedicates its existence towards encouraging the performance of mitzvot, has to tell you, in this particular case, until we have a Beit HaMikdash, where the Kohen can take that animal and offer it as a Korban Bechor, don't do the mitzvah. Now, they can't say don't do the mitzvah, because once that lamb is born if you didn't partner with a non-Jew in the mother sheep when she was pregnant, you've got a serious problem. That animal is Kodesh. It is sacred today. Difficult situation? Get out of it, but it takes a little bit planning. You must get out of it before the animal gives birth. That's basically what I had wanted to say before, and I ran out of time to say it. I'll explain again to the OU Radio audience that Torah Tibbetz Audio has been on Arutz Sheva, Israel National Radio, for over 10 years. In the beginning of that period, it was on actual radio here in Israel, and then it went on radio and internet simultaneously, and when Arutz Sheva was taken off the air by the government, it remained on the internet, but they still retain on the internet the flavor of a regular stream of radio broadcasting, and therefore the instructions that I got quite a while ago was to prepare two halves of the show, exactly 23 minutes each, 23 minutes and 23 minutes, plus a news update, a commercial here, a commercial there, an announcement here, an announcement there, resulted in a full hour show called Torah Tidbits Audio. For the OU Radio, I had, a while ago when we started, started adding to the length of the show because I wasn't restricted to the 46 minutes. And lately, I've been rushing out on Thursday after the recording in order to visit my children in Modi'in, and therefore have not been adding to it much. It just so happens that I'll be going tomorrow instead of this afternoon, and therefore I did have time to finish what I had wanted to say about Bechor Behemat Tahora and Bechor Peter Rechem, and now I will even add a nice song, and then sign off again with a Shabbat Shalom and El Hishtameah, which will be for you exclusively, the listeners on OU Radio. I hope that makes the situation clear, and it might clear up some of the things that are said on the show when my mind is thinking Arutz Sheva, or my mind is thinking OU Radio, and you're listening on the other one. It might come out a little confusing, but this is the story, and here's the song.
Shake a void, save a fish for I show you many shambles. I bet you need my boss. Look at you know to give me the call, my boss. The ash ready call.
Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.
Until next time, pleasant dreams.